As I said, it's all reruns. So last week, we talked about mindfulness of breathing as being the foundation of mindfulness practice. And I laid out a little bit the context for the mindfulness practice and what it is. And I realized some of you weren't here last week. But for those of you who are here and those of you who might have practiced the meditation a little bit during the week, what was your experience? What kind of questions do you have based on what you've done and your encounter with it? Do you have any? Yes.
I was surprised at how different each meditation was.
Yes.
Sometimes it seemed like I was able to just concentrate on my breathing, and other times my mind was just about
to. So that's a very important lesson to see. And realizing that how changeable meditation can be depending on many conditions. We learn to be a little bit more equanimous about the particular condition of meditation any particular day. The point of meditation is not necessarily to have some deep experience each time or to get really calm each time or whatever. The point is to have some equanimity about the particular experience you have that time. So there are times when your mind will be racing. Can you have some equanimity towards that fact rather than fighting it? And when the mind is really calm and deep and pleasant or whatever, can you have equanimity towards that and not try to hold on to it or not try to expect it again tomorrow? So the ups and downs that might happen are very useful for developing this kind of equanimity that we talk about, that is equanimity that is willing to allow things to be as they are without struggling against them or without judging them or without trying to hold on to them. Did you meditate at different times of the day or always at the same time?
Same.
Other experiences or questions that you might have had? We'll take the first few minutes of each class to give you a chance to ask questions. Okay, nothing. It's always interesting if there's no questions. How many of you were here last week?
Is it very common to see patterns of colors?
It's common. I don't know if it's very common, but it's common. Sometimes they can just be colors, lots of colors. Sometimes they can be actually geometric patterns. They can be there for different reasons. The point in meditation is, in mindfulness meditation, is not to get you interested in those, but rather to allow them to be there. And if the images or the visual effects are quite strong and compelling, then we bring a kind of balanced mindfulness, awareness, this is what's going on. A balanced awareness is not an awareness that gets curious or identifies with it. You find some meditators who get really excited. Lights mean something. Colors mean something. I'm a good meditator. And then you've gone too far.
Just enjoy the show.
Enjoy is a very interesting word because it's a verb that lends itself to meaning to being active. I think it's an act. To me, in my mind, it's kind of an act. You are going to enjoy something, as opposed to being more passive about. Maybe if you use the word both ways, but the point I'm trying to make is you don't want to get actively involved in enjoying it. If there's some pleasant experience in meditation, you want to allow that pleasant experience to pass through you, and you can experience it fully and appreciate it, feel the pleasantness of it, but you don't want to add anything on top of it where you're kind of indulging it or holding on to it or, you know, all kinds of different things we can do. Just let it kind of pass through you, and as it's passing through you, appreciate it fully, allow it to kind of manifest itself fully, but don't add anything extra to it.
I guess I always have this fine line between two things, like between watching it and understanding it or trying to understand it.
There's no fine line.
Well, I get like, what does that mean? Rather than, that's had there.
There's a huge world of difference between the two.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a huge line between and similarly, the difference between, like, you know, bringing yourself back to just watching your breath and, like, forcing yourself back into, like, state here, watching your breath rather than letting it happen and then saying, oh gosh, I'm not watching my breath anymore.
Yes, that's a very good point. Both of them are very good points. And the first is that the investigation is an important part of mindfulness, but it's a non-discursive investigation. We're not analyzing and figuring out or trying to find the meaning or the cause or the reason for things, but rather in being very carefully present for things, bringing presence to things, things might reveal themselves. And there might be a wake of little bit of thought after that, but it's very different to bring this non-discursive looking, presencing, as opposed to, you know, what is this and why is it there and what should I do with it and all that. That's a very important distinction. And the second one was?
Between kind of like forcing yourself yes. to watch your breath and watching your breath and finding out you're not there,
yeah.
pulling yourself back but not, you know, holding it.
The spirit of mindfulness is a spirit of nonviolence. There's no force that's required. And I think that'll become clear what that means as we go through the weeks talking about the instructions. There's no need to force yourself back from anything. Rather, what we learn in mindfulness is how to wake up in the midst of what is happening. But and ultimately, when you have the full instructions, you'll understand that mindfulness is simply the task of being fully present for what life has given you in that moment, the experience that's predominant in this moment. So there's no needing to leave anything to wake up. You don't have to go back to your breath to wake up. But initially, in the beginning of a person's meditation practice, the first few weeks, we emphasize the breath to help kind of give you an idea of how to be present and how to cultivate some presence, because the mind is quite, will carry you away so easily. And the breath is a stabilizer. So to the degree in which you might need some stabilization, the mind is just kind of chaotic, it's very useful to stay with the breath for a while, emphasize it, but not at the point of forcing it. It's kind of a gentle, nonviolent approach, So last week, I think I used sometimes the expression, rather than you returning to the breath, you allow the breath to return to you. So it's like almost like you can imagine that when you notice you're not being present for the breath, rather than forcing yourself back to pay attention, as if you're up here and you're going to force yourself back onto it, it's more like the curtains are closed and you pull the curtains open and the sunlight streams in. So we kind of create the space and awareness so the experience of breath can fill it again. So the breath can come to you rather than you going to the breath. Make sense enough? Yes?
I noticed that I'm so unacceptable of some noises, and it can even be the same noise. Like when Genevieve brought her baby, I was so irritated. And then when I saw it with the baby, I was fine. It was so weird. And I met like that with dogs or birds or fine, but dogs were earlier. If I acquire, like it can be the same noise, but created by a different thing, and it's irritating.
Well, with great respect to you, the question actually should be reflected back to you. I think that's something for you to explore. What happened? What is the difference? What happens that's different when it's a dog or when it's a bird? What is it? What how do you interpret the situation differently? How do you relate to your? How do you relate to your to the event? If you think it's an adult doing it versus a baby doing it, what are the interpretations? What are the judgments? What is the sense of self that involves? What has to do with your sense of relationship to what the other person? This is a wonderful story, I think, Chuang Tzu, if you're out in your sailboat on the lake, and another sailboat comes along and rams your boat, and you notice that there's no one in that boat. You know, there's just some boat got loose and it's kind of floating around, and it rams into your boat. You're not going to get particularly angry. Because it's just, you know, a boat. It's not responsible. It's just kind of floating there. But if there's a person in that boat, then, how could you have been? So we relate to it very differently. And is it necessary? What are the elements that are different in the different situations? And so all that's very interesting to study. Ultimately, in mindfulness, when we do mindfulness practice, there is no such thing as a distraction. And now that comes somewhat as a surprise to people who think that meditation is a kind of a matter of kind of focusing on one particular thing and finding some great calm in opposition to the world which might be chaotic. mindfulness practice doesn't create any boundaries or barriers or demarcation between what's inside and outside and what's permissible and not permissible. There's no distractions in mindfulness. It's simply something else to pay attention to. And what often happens, especially on retreats, it seems almost every retreat, someone will come to interviews to a teacher and say, there's someone sitting near me who is grunting when they breathe, or they're, you know, constantly making noise for some reason. And I find it very irritating. And, you know, can you ask them to move, or can you ask them to leave the retreat, or can you do something with them? And oftentimes we won't do anything, and we encourage them to kind of go back and bring their mindfulness to that event, what's going on inside of them and outside of them, and study. Because ultimately it's possible to find that the boundaries we put up and the judgments that we put up around these events are really somewhat arbitrary and unnecessary. That it's possible to hear the breathing of someone else just as you'd hear the wind blowing in the trees. And you can hear a sound outside of yourself as if there's no inside and outside. Even the notion there's an inside and outside is a concept that we overlay on top of our experience. And if we rest and trust just the experience itself in an open way, then we can be at ease regardless of what happens around us or inside of us. So we say there's no distractions in mindfulness. There's simply something else to pay attention to. And this will become clear today and the next days as we talk, that we're not trying to stay focused only on our breathing, but rather we use the breath as a foundation to kind of help us enter the present moment. But then if something else becomes predominant in the present moment, like a sound or an itch or something, then we leave the breath and allow the attention to rest in that new experience that's predominant. So the sound of the dog barking becomes our meditation if that's what's really loud. And you can do, you know, 40 minutes of dog meditation if a dog meditation is really loud. So my teacher in Burma, he was kind of the warrior spirit in him about how to practice. And when he went to the monastery to do his meditation practice as a young monk, he came there, this great zealot warrior who was going to sit there and, you know, get enlightened or bust, and he was going to be, you know, the. And I guess he had a certain kind of self-righteousness to himself around this, so he had this roommate who was the opposite, who was kind of, you know, took it easy, was easy-go-lucky, and, you know, whatever comes, happens, is fine. And so his roommate would go to sleep early at night, and he would sit up in his bed, you know, to wait into the night, meditating, being really diligent and whatever. But his roommate snored. So he describes how the first nights this happened, he got really irritated and really angry and fuming. How could this guy be so lazy? We're supposed to be practicing all the time. And, you know, here he's just wasting his life and he's snoring and he's not, you know, and he's disturbing me in my meditation. And so after a while, what he decided was, rather than fighting the experience of snoring and judging it, he made the snoring, the sound of the snoring, be the object of his meditation, of his mindfulness. And rather than focusing on his breath, he focused on that sound, just a hearing. And he got very concentrated on that sound, so much so that the concentration that came from listening to his roommate snoring became his entryway to very deep levels of mindfulness meditation, where the world opens up in new ways. So anything can be, you know, what we pay attention to. Now, if we do have reactions, judgments, aversions, criticisms, opinions, all these kinds of things we add extra to it, those things become what we study. A very important element of mindfulness practice is becoming cognizant of the relationship we have with the experience. There's two things which are always going on, we could say. There's the experience we're having, and then our relationship to that experience. So if you're sitting here and your knee hurts, we say in Buddhism that a painful knee is a neutral experience. And you can sit there it's possible to sit with tremendous equanimity and joy, just paying attention to your knee hurting. It doesn't have to be a big deal. Or it's possible to have your knee hurt and feel a tremendous amount of self-pity and aversion and fear and embarrassment and hate and all kinds of feelings and ideas and judgments around that knee hurting. And most of us don't distinguish very well between the direct experience we're having and the relationship we form with it. And so because we don't distinguish between them, we kind of, if we hate our knee pain, we kind of believe that that it's hateful in and of itself because we've intermingled the hate with the knee pain. You know, we do that with people. You know, we hate someone and we think they're a hateful person because we hate them. But the person who they are and the hate are two different things. And if we can separate out our relationship to the experience, then there's a possibility to see them as being different. There's a tremendous possibility for freedom or finding more ease or finding more generosity in your experience. So we study in mindfulness practice without analyzing it, without thinking about it. We just kind of pay attention. What is the relationship we have to this experience? You're sitting and following your breathing, and you find that it's very difficult to be with your breath. That you, well, actually, what you find is most of the breaths you're not there for them, and your mind keeps going lost in thought. You come back to your breathing. You stay for two or three breaths, and your mind goes off for 5 minutes. You come back for two or three breaths, and your mind goes off for it. That's the actual experience you're having. The relationship you have to that particular experience is, oh, I got this idea that I'm supposed to stay with my breath all the time, and here I can hardly do it, more than two or three breaths in every 5 minutes. Therefore, I must be failing. Therefore, I better try harder. And then we try harder and just makes things worse. And then we feel frustrated. And then we're angry at the meditation. We're angry at ourselves. We're angry at our breath. And we're angry at the teacher. And we're angry, you know, at the whole world because, you know, we've interpreted and made meaning out of the fact, the simple event, that you're with your breath, three breaths, and then you're not. Does that make sense to you? So there's what happens, and it's what we add to it. So I can't resist telling you the story that of Sylvia Borstein calling up the San Francisco Zen Center to go there to be a guest for a while. She was going to be kind of do a personal retreat at the Zen Center. And so she called up the office, and they said, oh, you want to talk to the guest manager. But the guest manager is not in. So why don't we take your name, and he'll call you back. He calls her back. She's not in. So he leaves a message saying, this is the guest manager. I'm sorry I missed you. Please give me a call. So she calls back the Zen Center. And she asks for the guest manager. And the office person says, oh, he's not in. So far, it's just the experience. Nothing more has happened, just the experience. Then Sylvia says to the office person, I guess it wasn't meant for me to be a guest at Zen Center. And the office worker says, no, I think all it means is Robert's not in. So this is what we do all the time. Constantly we make meaning out of things. Constantly we form a relationship, we form an interpretation and opinions that we overlay on top of what's the bare experience we're having. And some of it, of course, you know, is pretty obvious and sometimes appropriate. But a lot of our suffering, a lot of the stress and pain we have in life often comes from inappropriate overlay of interpretations, of opinions, of reactions to our experience. Mindfulness practice is kind of a subtle in that mindfulness practice itself doesn't tell you that anything you do is wrong. It'd be very easy for me to hear me say, well, then it's wrong to kind of interpret and do all these reactions on top of my experience. Mindfulness practice will never tell you that. What mindfulness is trying to do is point out to pay more careful attention to actually what's going on. And what you'll see if you pay careful attention is that your reaction to an experience and experience are not necessarily the same thing. And if you can start teasing apart those two things, or seeing that they're two different things, you'll find tremendous opportunities for ease and freedom in your life. So we study in mindfulness practice, we investigate are the relationship we have to our experience and the experience itself. Make sense? Well, that's a lot to say. So let's do a little sitting. So So take a comfortable but alert posture. And for those of you who were not here last week, if you want to stay at the end of the class, I can talk a little bit about posture, meditation posture to you. I spent a lot of time last week on that. And then softly close your eyes. And in the simplest and most direct way you can, just acknowledge, be aware of how you are right now. Can you be aware of yourself without an interpretation or judgment of what's happening? Just how it is to be alive at this moment. Feelings in your body, emotions, thoughts. Mindfulness practice is as simple as just that. It's as accessible as just that, just recognizing now what is your experience. For the meditation practice, it's often nice at the beginning of the sitting to take two or three deep breaths as a way of connecting to the breath, connecting to your body. As you breathe in, you can really feel the connection with your body from the inside. And then as you breathe out, breathing out a little bit longer maybe than you normally would, relaxing and letting go. And also at the beginning of a meditation, it's sometimes nice to scan through the body to see if there's any places of holding in the body of tension that might be relatively easy to let go of. Sometimes the forehead can be relaxed. Thighs. The jaw. Sometimes as you're breathing out, it's possible to soften lightly the shoulders. And sometimes it's nice to let go or relax the stomach. Letting the stomach be soft, the abdomen be soft, hanging out. And then within your body, as part of your body, become aware of how the body experiences your breathing. Feeling it in the place where the breath is most predominant, clearest. It could be in the stomach, the rising and falling there, or the expansion and contraction in your chest somewhere. Or the sensations of the air as it flows in and out through your nostrils. And what you want to do is to sense and feel as gently and tenderly as you can, and as continuously as you can, the experience your body has of breathing. letting your body be conscious of its experience of breathing. And there's a matter of factness to mindfulness. You're being with the breath just as it is. No need for it to be different. But if you have a reaction to it, a relationship or opinion to it, notice that that's different than the matter of fact experience itself. And you might find it helpful to very softly, silent, soft whisper in the back of the mind to label or name the breath as you're breathing, rising or falling, or in and out, as a very soft way of nudging, encouraging the mind to stay present for the breathing. Attending to the breath as you would attend to some loving person, someone you love or care for. A gentle attending presence to your breathing body. Naturally, the mind will wander off into thoughts. And whenever you notice this has happened, when this is the bare experience, no need to interpret it or react against it, but matter-of-factly come back to attending to the breath again. Like the waves of the ocean land back and forth across the shore, so allow the comings and goings of breathing, the expansion and contractions, the inhalations and exhalations, allow them to wash across the shore of your awareness. Relaxing your stomach so that the inhalations might arise more naturally by themselves. And now for the last few minutes of the sitting, let go of paying attention to the breathing. And instead, look through your body and find the strongest physical sensation in your body right now. And if you're not sure which is the strongest, doesn't matter, just choose one. And let your attention feel and sense and be present for the strongest physical sensation in your body right now. Noticing if it's relevant, the difference between the actual experience and any reaction or interpretation you have about it. And if you can see a difference, then simply rest your awareness in the physical experience itself, allowing it to be there. No need for it to go away or change. And just feel it as it is. Get to know it better by having your attention there. And as you do, notice what happens to the experience. And then I'll end this sitting with hitting the bell 3 times. And rather than opening your eyes right away, do listening meditation, allowing yourself to receive the ringing of the bell for 3 times. A useful concept for understanding this mindfulness practice is the concept of the foreground and background of experience. What we try to do in mindfulness is to let our attention be fully present, best we can, with whatever is in the foreground of your experience. Commonly, when we first sit to meditate, we kind of let the breath be the foreground of attention. We give some preference to the breath by directing our attention there. And as long as other experiences are in the background, thoughts or feelings or sounds or whatever, there's no need to attend to them. All you need to do is to stay carefully with what's in the foreground, with the breath. Sometime, sooner or later, something from the background will come into the foreground, will become predominant, will become stronger, more compelling than the breath. When something becomes more compelling than the breath, then rather than struggling with what's compelling, you know, trying to kind of stay with the breath and kind of resist the compelling thing. The practice is simply let go of the breath and let your attention then rest with this new thing in the foreground, letting the breath recede into the background. So if there are sounds that are quite loud and they become compelling for whatever reason, you don't have to resist those sounds. You can just let go of the breath and just do listening meditation for however long that sound is compelling. And once it's no longer compelling or it's gone away, then you can go back to the breathing. The same way with sensations in the body. Sooner or later, there are sensations in the body which will become compelling, will come into the foreground. At that point, you simply let go of the breath. There's no need to struggle between the breath and this physical sensation. You just let go of the breath and let your attention go to that place in your body and receive those sensations, kind of sense those places in the body. So one of the most common places where people feel uncomfortable in sitting, especially if you're sitting on the floor, is the knees. If you're not used to it, the knees begin hurting. At that point, if the knees hurt strongly and compelling, we let go of the breath and let the attention just receive the sensations of pain in the knee. And sensing, and then we try to sense it fully. What is this experience? There's always this kind of slight kind of, what is this experience? Not to figure it out or analyze it, but simply to, so you could help us to encourage us to feel it more fully. Because if we hold ourselves at a distance to something like pain, it's just pain. But if we sense it kind of in the middle of what it is directly, you'll find it's made up of many different sensations. It might be made up of heat. It could be searing heat. It could be made up of various kinds of sensations of stabbing or piercing or twisting or pulling or hardness or, you know, there can be particular sensations that make up that experience. Different kinds of pains are made up of different kinds of intense sensations. As we begin exploring and feeling the direct sensations of what we label pain, that experience changes and opens up in new ways. It's kind of like, maybe like, you know, if you look at a movie, on a movie screen, it looks like these characters are moving there. Like all this activity and action and people are shooting each other and kissing each other and, you know, all this wonderful stuff is happening, you know, action-wise. But most movie producers know that nothing ever happens, no action ever happens on the screen. It's an illusion because things are happening. The individual still frames are appearing so fast. What's 16 or 32, 24 frames per second? So the eye can't necessarily see 24 frames per second. So it constructs movement. But there's no movement there, just like, you know, just, you know, these individual things happening. So in the same way, if we hold ourselves at a distance from our experience, we tend to construct meaning or construct kind of an abstraction of what that is and live in that abstraction. But as we begin sensing and feeling more carefully the direct experience, it changes and opens up in new ways that are often quite surprising and often become much easier to live with than if we just stay at the abstract level. So physical pain, just as an example, is like that. If we hold ourselves at a distance from it, it's often much more difficult than if we enter into it with mindfulness, really feel it. Entering physical pain with mindfulness is the opposite, the radical opposite of most messages you get in our culture about physical pain. Most messages you get is avoid it at all costs. Take the aspirin, take the drug, take the alcohol, do anything you can to avoid the pain. Pain is to not be experienced. Now, to some degree, that's useful advice. To some degree, it actually is very unuseful advice, especially when there's a lot of our psychological life and tied up in what happens in our body. In our, you know, it's like tension in your shoulders. Tension in your shoulders is a fascinating psychological event. And if you just find some way to just eliminate the pain kind of mechanically without understanding the deeper issues of what's going on, it'll just come back. I don't know if that was the best example, but the point is that is when we try to do mindfulness, whatever the sensation is that's compelling, we want to enter it and feel it really carefully, sense it, and let the attention rest there. And of course, the mind will wander off into thoughts or into reactions. And whenever that happens, just softly, non-violently, come back again and rest in the experience. The mind will react and flit off, and just come back and rest there as long as that's compelling. There can be great pleasant sensations that arise in meditation. Great experience of tingling delight and warm flushes of delightful feelings in the cheeks or in the chest. It can be quite intense, the pleasurable feelings that sometimes can happen. And the same thing there is that whatever strong sensation is compelling, we want to bring our attention to feel it carefully what it is. What are the actual sensations that make it up? And once you start noticing the actual sensations, where actually are the sensations? Like the knee pain, where is it exactly? If you stay at a distance from it, the knee pain is experienced as the whole knee. I'm supposed to repeat now. I've been being trained to be mindful of what happens to the tape recorder. And when it flips over, I'm supposed to stop. So this finally has been success. Malice has been trying to do this, teach me this trick for a long time, and now we've made it. Now I've made a big deal of it, and we're all lost track of what I was talking about. So much for mindfulness. So what was I talking about? Organ of consciousness, kind of. The body is an organ of sensing, and that's why it's an organ of consciousness. And we can sense or be conscious through our body. And it's fascinating how much of our life is lived and experienced through our body. Our emotions are embodied events. Our thinking sometimes is actually, if you're very attentive, you can feel the way your thinking even happens in an embodied way. Our reactions and response to the world around us often happens through our body. This body is a tremendously valuable vehicle for wisdom and understanding about ourselves. And also a great vehicle for delight and intimacy with the world. So developing mindfulness of the body is a very important part of mindfulness practice. And the basic instructions are as simple as I just said. When something in the body is compelling, more than the breath, then simply let go of the breath and let your attention rest in a simple, kind of easy way with that experience to get to know it better. You can very quietly name the physical experience. We use naming sometimes in this practice as a way of using thoughts to help us stay present rather than letting the idle mind go off in whatever thoughts it wants to go off on. Because a name is kind of like a subtle thought. So if you feel the knee pain, you can just say pain. Just kind of very, very, very softly in the mind to encourage you to actually feel it more fully, to acknowledge it. If you feel great feelings of delight or joy or warmth in your chest, you can just name it delight or warmth as a way of helping you to stay there for it. And you can name it and stay present for it as long as it's compelling. A 40-minute session of meditation where the knee is the compelling event and you're able to stay with the knee, that's a wonderful meditation. That's enough. The idea is to stay present for what's compelling. So at the end of this last sitting, I asked you to kind of look through your body to find the strongest physical sensation and hang out with it a little bit. What happened to some of you as you did it? What was your experience in doing that? Yes?
Started to dissipate.
Anybody else have that experience?
Yeah. I had pain in my back and it went away when I focused.
It's quite common that bringing attention to some place of especially of tension or holding or pain will begin dissolving it for different reasons. One of the reasons is that it's very hard to continue holding the tension when there's awareness there, especially if it's relatively mild kind of tension. Also, as the attention becomes more fine, penetrating, we start seeing that the experience itself is arising and passing as an impermanent experience. Anyone else? Other experiences? Did it get worse for someone? Stronger as you watched it?
Yeah, I found it. It didn't necessarily get worse. It got more intense.
Uh-huh.
It became stronger.
So there are three things that might happen as you to pay attention to anything. It might get weaker and go away. It might stay the same, and it might get stronger. And it's not your job to decide which it's supposed to be. Your job is just to go along for the ride, to be mindful of what's actually happening. Could some of you see the difference between the experience and the ways you interpreted or reacted to it, or your relationship to it?
I had an experience that was kind of hard to sit with. It was sort of the surge of energy, almost in my shoulders, like I wanted to explode. And that was really hard to just be there with.
Sometimes when there are strong sensations like that, or sometimes it takes the form of restlessness or whatever, just the fact that we sit still through it and hardly aware of, you know, kind of careful awareness of it, the fact that we sit still and had enough presence to sit still means you had a successful meditation. You don't have to do anything more than that. And sometimes that's the way it is. And so can we develop some acceptance of that, some allowing of that? Can we notice our reaction to that? Are we starting to hate it or getting impatient? Are we adding things on top of it? Or it's enough just to be there with the strong explosive feelings. Or do we add things on top of it? We can explore that. Sometimes it's difficult to sit still and just feel what's going on. Anything else you want to say about that, anyone?
Oftentimes, visualize energy fields and cycles in your body.
So he says sometimes he visualizes energy fields cycling through the body as you sit. Different people will think different ways. Some people will think primarily through words, and some people through images and visions, visualizations. The seeing of things inside the body, like you're watching, looking and seeing the breath kind of rolling around inside of you, or seeing whatever you're seeing through the mind's eye, it's one level removed from the actual direct experience. It's a kind of, in a way, a kind of a concept, in the way that visions can also be a concept. What we want to do is to feel it directly as sensation, rather than stay in the conceptual level. So if that happens to you, you're seeing energy moving through your body, you don't have to stop seeing it, but rather see if you can rest your attention in the direct sensations that your mind is using to build the images.
I find myself trying to work to encourage it and build it up. It seems to relax me and there's a rhythm to it.
So he said, so if he encourages this energy moving through his body, it helps him to relax. So two things about that. It's fine to do. There's no problem with that, doing that. It can make good sense to do things to help you relax. But it's not mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice is not a practice of trying to change anything that's going on with you. It's not trying to manipulate any of your experiences inside of you. It's not trying to encourage anything or resist anything or stop anything. And it's not trying to do anything, not trying to do the practice in a sense to get an immediate result, like to get calmer, to be calmer or whatever. Mindfulness practice in and of itself is simply the practice of being present for what is actually here. That's all. It's very uncomplicated and simple. And it goes against the grain of the way many of us live our life all the time, where we don't accept the things as they are, but we're constantly judging or interpreting or manipulating or wanting change. Make sense? I'll tell you a story that I often read in introductory class. I think I'll remember it well enough. This man, he writes, I was miserable, I was neurotic, and things were terrible in my life, and I knew that I had to change. And what was worse is all my friends told me, you have to change, you have to change. And the more I tried to change, the more miserable I was, the less I could succeed. And then finally I came across a friend who told me, don't change, I love you just the way you are. And those words were music to my ears. Don't change, I love you just the way you are, don't change. And in having that person accept me as I was able to accept myself and relax around who I was, and as I accepted myself as I was, I changed. So we don't try to change. What we're trying to do is really to accept ourselves as we are at this moment. And this magic happens if we do that, because most of our life is made up of not accepting the present moment, manipulating and changing it. So you can come to the meditation in kind of a larger way. Everybody comes because they want some change. They want some improvement in their life. But in the moment-to-moment practice of it, you have to let go of all attempts to try to change anything or have a different experience than what you're having. That's the way the practice works. That works the best that way, and it has the most radical and transformative properties of the practice come about by learning this ability to just be with things as they are without trying to transform anything. Paradox of change. There are a number of benefits in cultivating mindfulness of the body. One of them is it's very useful to become familiar with your body. As I said earlier, the body is a tremendous organ of understanding, of reactions, of responses, and kind of an antenna of how we relate to the world, how we relate to ourselves, what our emotions are, what our feelings are all kind of can be discovered in the body. The body never lies. The mind is very tricky. It's so tricky that sometimes we lie to ourselves. But the body doesn't lie. And if you pay attention to what's going on in your body, it's a phenomenal truth-sayer about what's going on. And it's one. I think it was Jung had it slightly wrong. He said dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. And maybe it's royal, I don't know, but a better road to the unconscious, the royal road to the unconscious, is the body. The body is this tremendous bridge to the deeper subconscious parts of our lives, because these deeper movements of our life manifest themselves physically in our body, and we can tap into them and feel them when we start waking up and being present in our body to what's going on. So when I sit and talk, give these classes, I'm regularly stopping and checking in with my body as I sit here, because I'm kind of talking. It's a little bit hard for me to kind of tune in all the time to my subtle reactions and responses to what's going on here. You know, what are you thinking, and do you like me, and you know, are you understanding what I'm saying, or are you criticizing what I'm saying in your mind? I mean, you know, all these reactions a speaker might have, right? But those that have some consequence for me, those that kind of grab me in some ways, get registered. My stomach might get a little bit tighter, I might lean forward, my shoulders might go up slightly. And by regularly checking into what's going on in my body as I talk, I can kind of sense the ways in which I get caught up in my reactions and my responses and my fears or whatever. I found a tremendous, it's much easier for me to be balanced and clear what's happening if I stay with my body. It's hard enough as it is, but I try. I mean, it's a tremendous help for me. So part of the function of mindfulness of the body is to develop familiarity with our embodied life, to live inside our body, to live through our body. Another function of mindfulness of the body, which is that our physical body gives us a large range of different kinds of feeling sensations. There are pleasant sensations and unpleasant sensations we might feel. What we're trying to cultivate in mindfulness is the ability to stay present in a non-reactive way for whatever life gives us in any given moment. So if it's not only are we learning to become familiar with the body, but we're learning the potential, the possibility we all have to be present for an experience without reacting to it, without jumping onto the reaction bandwagon and making a big story out of it, or living out of it, or acting out of that reaction, but rather it has some equanimity to this particular experience. That is a phenomenally useful thing to develop in our life, because we cannot always control what happens to us in life. But we can have some cultivate the ability to be graceful, at ease, equanimous, in the midst of what life happens to give us. And one of the ways to train us to have that is to sit in the middle of our body and allow whatever arises in our body to be there without any movement to make it go away or hold on to it more. So we're cultivating familiarity with the body and our life, and we're cultivating this ability to be present. Our presence is non-reactive. It doesn't mean you don't have feelings and responses and ideas, but you have the steadiness or the stability in your presence that lubricates the whole situation. That makes sense? When I was when I first practiced Vipassana in Thailand, one of my first Vipassana retreats, there was an opening talk of the retreat, And at the end of the opening talk, as everybody was leaving the talk, the teacher, kind of as an afterthought, kind of said to the few people who happened to be kind of more or less near him, he said, "Oh, by the way, don't do anything that takes you out of your body." And that statement was such a surprise to me at that time. Because up until that time, when I came to do my meditation practice, I thought the body was, only the function of the body was simply to let you sit here. You know, just you had to have a body, you had to place it somewhere, so the body allowed you to do that. And the body experiences I had, they were just a nuisance. They got in the way. You know, I have knee pain and back pain and all these things, you know, sensations in my body. What a nuisance, you know. And I would just try to get rid of them or deny them or try to focus on the breath as a way of kind of holding onto the breath so I wouldn't have to pay attention to what's going on in my body. And then when this teacher said, "Don't do anything that takes you out of your body," that kind of, wow, that's an unusual. Why did he say it? I didn't even understand what he was saying. It was such a strange instruction. But when you hear instructions that seem strange, you don't understand, sometimes that's the instruction you should spend some time trying to live with. So the next days of the retreat, I lived without instructions, trying to make sense out of it for myself. And I noticed how often I was not in my body. How often, it wasn't I was having some kind of astral, out-of-the-body experience, but rather, I would subtly, my kind of psychic sense of presence would be suddenly, often shifted in front of me a foot or two. As if, for example, when it was time to go for lunch. Lunch was this great time on retreat where I had this out-of-the-body experience. Because I'd be leaning kind of into, you know, walking towards lunch, to food. Like the food was like the most important thing in the world. Very, very little happens on a retreat, externally. So on retreats, lunch is a big event. So, you know, I was more kind of, I was ahead of myself. Or you're thinking about the future, about what you're going to say, you know, to your boss tomorrow. And there's a way in which we kind of leave our presence in our body and we're kind of projected into this kind of virtual realm of our thoughts. And I could see how my subtle shift of attention moved out of my center of gravity in my body, also shifted often when I left my body. And what I learned in that retreat was to come back and let myself really be in my body and experience my body within the body rather than leaving it and then letting the center of my presence be somewhere in the kind of virtual world of thoughts, preoccupations. It was very powerful for me to learn to live in my body, come back into my body. Part one of the reasons we try to take a balanced posture in meditation practice, either sitting on the zafu or sitting on a chair, is in a balanced, aligned posture, is a posture that allows us to settle into our body the best. If you're reclining in your sofa and try to meditate, you might get calm, but your body won't be given the same kind of chance to settle on itself. And settle the body and our presence into itself is very, very helpful for living a conscious life. What else? Any questions around any of this so far? Yes?
I went to sleep. I've never done that before. It seems it's going to
fit. Take it as a good sign. Sleep happens for different reasons in meditation. For most people, especially at the end of the day, it's because they're tired. And what we try to do is we don't try to put ourselves to sleep in meditation, but we don't fight it either. There's no need to fight anything. Rather, if you start feeling yourself sleepy, then what we do is we bring our attention to the physical sensation of what sleepiness is like. We become the world's expert on the sensations of tiredness coming across the body, the heaviness in the eyes and tingling or warmth in the cheeks, or the heaviness in the shoulders, or whatever way you might feel it. And that does two things. One is you're cultivating mindfulness of what's actually happening. Two, by investigating or bringing energy to your actual sleepiness, sometimes it wakes you up. But if you fall asleep, that's a good sign. It means you're relaxed, and you might need to catch up, so just don't worry about it. You're asleep, you're asleep. And when you wake up, just resume the practice. Sometimes sleep happens in meditation as a defense mechanism, because something, as the mind chatter begins to quiet down a little bit, and as the physical activity of always keeping ourselves engaged stops, then the deeper currents of our life have a chance to show themselves. For example, it's possible for someone to keep themselves always going and going and going, so they don't have to face the fact that they're depressed or sad or angry or whatever. So if they're always keeping themselves busy and holding themselves from themselves in that way, and they stop to meditate, and everything comes to a stop, all the distractions, and lo and behold, they find out what's going on, sometimes it can be too much. And sometimes people will go asleep as a way of protecting themselves from those experiences. But generally, it's because people are, you know, just tired. If you notice you're falling asleep or getting really tired, you can do a number of different things that might help you stay awake. One is to sit up straighter, to have your spine be more energized, and that bringing more energy into the posture can be more wakeful. You can also open your eyes as you meditate, kind of having them open to 45 degrees to the floor, and having the eyes open, especially sometimes even people like to have a light source nearby, and the brightness of the light will also stimulate you to stay more awake. Sometimes people, when they're really sleepy in meditation, will stand and just do their meditation standing. And it's a lot harder to fall asleep standing. Just standing meditation. If you go on retreat, sometimes you'll see, you know, occasionally see people standing during the retreat. Why?
To wake up.
Oh, you can. I was like, yeah, you can do things like pull. You can just pinch your earlobes. It brings energy. Yes.
I was pretty aware of my level of discomfort when I was beginning to do the breathing, and towards the end, as I got more comfortable, I was concentrating more on my breathing, but I know I wander off, and I'm kind of thinking, well, I can't remember what I was thinking about when I was wandering off. Is that a good sign, or, I mean, am I supposed to remember what I was thinking about, or?
No.
I mean, I guess it's something that's not major, but.
There's no problem. Your experience was that your mind wandered off, you came back to your breath, and that you had no memory of what you were thinking about. You just leave it. Can be just, that's how simple it was. You can leave it that simple. Mm-hmm. You don't have to analyze or have doubts or wonder, you know, did I do it wrong or was there a better way of doing it? Mm-hmm. All that is the extra stuff we add on top of it. Mm-hmm. You can really keep it simple. Just, this was my experience. I can just leave it as that. Okay. Yes. I might have. It's often useful to sit in the same place and the same time each day, because the association helps you kind of settle more quickly if you have that regularity and rhythm to it. Also, sometimes we're more likely to do it if there's some commitment to this particular time, because, you know, that time, you know, you don't have to decide each day, well, when should I do it today, and maybe the morning's not good today, so I'll do it in the afternoon, and then the afternoon comes around and we're busy, and well, maybe I'll do it at night before I go to bed, and then, you know, but if we always say we have a commitment to doing it at the same time, you're much more likely to do it. And I don't know if I said this last week, but I think it's very important, actually, very useful, skillful, to have a commitment to sit every day at this more or less at the same time for a certain length of time, regardless of whether you want to or not. Because it's very useful to take meditation practice outside of the world of your preferences. Most things we do, to some degree, we tie in with our preferences, especially something like meditation, which is optional anyway, besides, you know. So, but if we only sit when we want to, people will find they sit, either they'll sit when they're feeling miserable and they want to feel better, or they'll only sit when they feel good, because they don't want to sit when they're miserable because it's miserable. And by having a commitment to sit every day for a certain length of time and take it out of the world of your preferences, then it's much easier and more to see yourself honestly and process your whole life as it passes through. The part of the point of mindfulness practice as a regular meditation practice is to learn to be present for the full range of what it is like to be a human being, whether you like it or not. Whether you like it or not has no bearing on meditation practice, mindfulness practice. What we're trying to do is become free, not kind of always do what we like. Make sense? Yes?
Will you be mentioning walking meditation in one of these nights?
Maybe. In the last years, I haven't during the 5-week introductory course. And sometimes what I do is, my intention is to do it like 2 or 3 weeks after the 5-week introductory course for those people who are still left. Oh yes. So I might be remiss, and maybe I'm not doing a good job by leaving it out, but that seems to be what happens. Maybe I'll, because you brought it up this way, maybe I'll be inspired to include it this time. Yes.
I find myself again and again breathing and to my heartbeat. And in fact, you know, using the in, like it's in, out. And I even find myself counting. So it's usually 3 in, 5 out, something like that. Is it reasonable?
If you find yourself that's what you're doing kind of automatically, then mindfulness practice is simply to be mindful of that event happening. But the practice itself, in terms of bringing attention to something, is to actually sense the breath most fully as it is, and not to add these overlays on top of it. Counting the heartbeats compared to the breath is a relatively abstract event to do, and it actually keeps you separate from the experience. And to be actually monitoring the breath and the heartbeat more than just kind of noticing, you know, very matter-of-factly, is again making it more complicated than it needs to be. What we will constantly want to do is to come and let ourselves rest or nudge ourselves towards being with the actual sensations and not the abstractions the mind can make about it. So if you start counting the breath, you're involved in abstractions. And also with a labeling, I encourage naming the breath very subtly, in or out. You want to make that very simple also, but you want to be on the guard that the naming, because you're naming each breath, in, out, or rising, falling, that the naming doesn't become mechanical, or the naming doesn't take over. We're so mental, many of us, that we get lost in the world of our thoughts so easily, that we sometimes get lost in the mental world of the name. What we're trying to do is use the subtle naming, very soft naming, to mostly, if anything, get lost in the world of our sensations, to drop down into the physical sensation. So it sounds to me like you're kind of leaving the sensation and just kind of being a little bit more in the abstraction of the event.
It's like music. We've got two things going.
Yeah, so just let it be that way. But you don't need to count it.
No.
The counting is an abstraction.
Yes.
What you also want to be, for you, especially since you've done a lot of practice now, is what you want to study a little bit is it soothing to have this connection between the heartbeat and the breath? And are you very subtly leaning yourself into being soothed by that experience? And if you are, that's adding something extra to the situation. We're not using our meditation to soothe ourselves. We're using the meditation to simply be present for what's actually happening. So let's sit a little bit to end. Many of us in this part of the world, I think, spend much of our day in our thoughts, in our heads. And many of us, because of that, are somewhat imbalanced in our life, away from being embodied. The Buddha taught that the mind and the body are a unit, inseparable from each other. It's very useful for many of us when we live in an imbalanced life to really emphasize the breath and the body, coming back to it over and over again, as a way to help create a balance between the mind and the body. So take a couple of deep breaths and let go into the body as you breathe out. And then letting your breath breathe itself. There's no particular way you need to breathe, just whatever way it's breathing naturally. Or become aware of the body breathing, the sensations of breath. The experience of being alive, our aliveness, is experienced through having a body, being in a body. For most of us, when we stop having the sensations that we have of our body, of our breath, that's when we no longer be alive. The sensations you have of breathing are quite precious. Simply rest where they are coming and going, the inhalations and exhalations, becomes a kind of homecoming to ourselves. Coming back again, again, and again to the breath, letting the breath be your guide to being in present time, in lived time. Or if some strong sensation in your body or strong sound arises into the foreground, then you can let go of the breath and attend to this sensation. And then when it's no longer compelling, or it's gone away, then you can quietly let the breath return to the center of your practice. The end of the out-breath is a kind of letting go. Without emphasizing it, remember to stay present for that letting go. And then allow the in-breath to arise on its own. So next week, I'll talk about emotions and how emotions are incorporated and included as part of mindfulness practice. And the more familiar, the more you practice with these first two pieces, the mindfulness of the breath and the mindfulness of the body, the easier it'll be to practice and to make sense of the instructions for how to include emotions. It's like the body is the foundation for how to include our emotional life as part of the practice. So I encourage you to keep it this simple, just the breath and the sensations in your meditation. And you might also take maybe one activity that you do regularly during the week. Perhaps, you know, it could be anything. It could be cooking or talking on the phone or reading or driving or whatever. And in that activity, pay attention to what's going on in your body. Develop some mindfulness of what's happening physically with your posture, with the sensations inside of you, with your body, with the different muscles in your body as you do this kind of activity. And develop some familiarity over a week in this regular thing that you do. So that the practice is not simply something you do only for the cushion, for your meditation time, but this practice is something you bring also into your daily life. I'll end with a poem. slightly paraphrased from Lynn Park's poem. Take the time to meditate. It is the sweet oil that eases the hinge into the garden, so the doorway can swing open easily. You can always go there. Consider yourself blessed. These stones that break your bones will build the altar of your love. Your home is the garden. Carry its odor hidden in you into the city. Suddenly your enemies will buy seed packets and fall to their knees to plant flowers in the dirt by the road. They'll call you friend and honor your passing among them. When asked, who was that? They will say, oh, that one has been beloved by us since before time began. This from people who would have trampled over you to maintain their advantage. Give everything away except your garden. Give away your worry, your fear, your small-mindedness. Your garden can never be taken from you. Take the time to be mindful. Thank you. Good night.